the theme for the afternoon talk with you is the doorways of liberation. There are multiple ways that we can find ourselves looking at life, and these may be drawn upon experiences, from theories, from what we have been told by others with authority, and of course what we tell ourselves. And one of the convincing and sometimes unquestioning messages of the time is around the view that we all have a choice. And in some respect, we've been sold the idea, and there can be an unquestioning loyalty and obedience to this contemporary view, everybody has a choice. But if you and I scratch just a little bit beneath the surface, then we might start to look, see, and feel and view in a different way altogether. And that to me starts, in fact, with the very beginning of life. Who chose to be born? Who was out in space and said, well, I think I'll take Israel? Or even worse, the United Kingdom. Or even worse, the USA. All right. Apologies for all citizens here. Right. Who would choose the particular parents that we have? Who chose the body? Who chose the gender? Who chose the aging process? Who chose sickness? Who chose pain? Who chooses dying? So some of the things which really, really, really matter to us as human beings, choice, it's a fiction. It's something which has been heaped upon us. Everybody has a choice. But it's not only there as well, of course. There are people who experience enormous degrees of difficulty, problems of life, unhappiness, despair, substance abuse, crises and tragedies, accidents and conflicts, victims of circumstances, have an enormous impact on human life. Choice? Who would choose to be depressed, worried, unhappy, confused? And wouldn't a person going through some of the heartaches of life, the tragedies and torments of life, wouldn't the person immediately having to deal with that say, well, I choose it to stop? And would the person who says, I choose it to stop, will it make a scrap of difference? Can one just stop mental illness just like that? Stop the unhappiness and the despair just like that? So we've been told this language of choice, but in digging a little bit deeper, we see it's rather superficial. Christopher wears a black long-sleeved vest today. What else have I got over there? A white one and a brown one. Took hours to make the decision. So choices are often a kind of supermarket event when we're kind of out of touch. So as we get a little bit deeper, the whole area of choices become a little bit more shallow. Sometimes we say, looking a bit more closely and intimately, I can't make up my mind. I'm sitting on my meditation cushion, I'm walking up and down, and I'm wondering what to do next. And I feel I have so many choices to make. And I could choose to do this, and I could choose to that. And it's not that there's any ethic involved. Might be a nice idea to follow this one through. It could be a good idea to do that. I could go here, I could stay there, I could be with this person, I could not be with this person. You know all those songs and dances of the inner life. Could one just say, well, my choice is to stop that right now. I'll have a completely enlightened, clear, illuminated day, full of love and compassion, which people will notice and observe quickly, of course. And we could say, this will be my day today, this is my choice. Because we have a choice. Do we? So the idea of choice has with it the chooser and the object. The choice. Touching a little bit more deeply into this, if we come to the barest actualities in which the self is not living in this appearance of choices so easily and so quickly, acknowledges a certain, as it were, ability to choose a few things in life, we might say, sits on the meditation cushion and walks up and down, and perhaps has the opportunity to come to a certain quietness in the being there. Not that we chose it, because if we sat on the meditation cushion, we'd choose it immediately. But in the small choices that we make, we could say it sends, so to speak, one in the right direction, to go a little deeper into the being. I can't just choose to go deeper. Something has to evolve. Organic life has to respond. We have to be allowed, we have to be, as it were, pulled into the deeper. And in that movement and pulling into the deeper, the world of choices gets less. So initially, we may have been experiencing lots of choices. I could do this, I could do that. I could go here, I could go there, whatever. As the inner being comes to a greater calmness of being, the number of choices get less and less. And guess what? We feel happier about it. We're tired of the confusion of not being able to make our mind up with all of these neurotic choices. The inner being is getting quieter. There is more calm with the inner being, and the number of choices is getting less and less and less. And sometimes we're not concerned with choices. And there can be, as a doorway to liberation, a real appreciation of an abiding choicelessly, not choosing for something. It may be, as a number of you have reported, The deep being vast, sometimes the deep touches on the problems and the pains and the difficulties. It's an important doorway. Sometimes the doorway to liberation is through hell. Heaven's better, but sometimes it's hell. So it can be that in the touching of the deep, sometimes we experience hell, a real hell inside. And we can feel in the very cellular makeup that this hell is hard to deal with, hard to face up to, and it has an impact on the perceptions. Most days, teachers or those of you in groups will hear of this from others or oneself. And when something is painful in the deep, it moves through and very easily it will catch upon a perception. So there's some anguish or frustration or agitation or heaviness, whatever it might be in the deep. And consciousness can't bear to stay there too long. And then we find very easily that the perceptions, that painful difficulty, hook. It hooks, understand hook? It gets caught on the perception. And so whatever we look at, we have a dark view. We might look at ourselves and have a dark view. We might look at another and have a dark view, or at life in general. So the pressure from the hell lands on the perception, and then the view of life, oneself, others, and particulars is dark. And we actually think that that's how it is. It isn't. It's something has moved in the dark of the being, the non-seeing, that means the dark of the being, and it's just landed an object, and we think it's the object. It's not. It's the movement that's gone on inside. We need to be mindful of this, because sometimes there are people, and I hear the voices regularly, who while engaging in the process of meditation, may employ, and here too of course, as well as elsewhere, a very, very similar attitude, methodology, technique, or whatever. May even come on a retreat and sit in exactly the same spot as the last 20 occasions. Apart from being a habit. But it can be that one finds when it's something hellish that the meditations, sitting, walking, standing and reclining, one keeps landing in the same difficult place. And one's not choosing to, once again. But it could be the way of the meditation form and method, the technique and the attitude, the posture, the conditions come together, and one finds, wow, I'm back exactly in the same pain that I was in on the last retreat and the one before and the one in the last lifetime. We have to be creative. It's not running away from, but to be creative. When the view arises from the pain, I'll get to heaven, hang in. When, tomorrow morning, anyway, when the view arises, which is impacting on the painful perception, one of the things that we tend to notice is the language, one has to be careful, of cause. Cause, C-A-U-S-E, cause. And cause, single cause, not always, but often involves the self, the causer, the one who causes. And this view, common for all of us, of the one who causes, when it's got the dark wrapped up in it, it can only lead to resentment, fault-finding, blame. And the darkness of that, in the metaphor, is the blindness to mindfulness with, as the Buddha said, clear comprehension. When I'm under the influence of the dark inside of myself, it's at the cost of mindfulness with's important here, clear comprehension of what is going on. And when that happens for us, the self and cause easily arises. I read a passage from the Buddha. Leah and I were just touching upon this while ago. And a person came to the Buddha and said, "Do I cause all my own suffering? That really is all my fault. I just bring it all on myself." There. And some people will say that. Some people will draw that foolish and rather dangerous conclusion. There. And some, who are completely out to lunch, will say, "Well, you chose that. You chose to be miserable. You choose to be angry. You choose to behave the way you are. You choose to do what you do." As though there's such a great deal of inner space and awareness that the choice or the cause, in this case to oneself, was made. Who in their right mind would get up in the morning and say to themselves, "I'm going to cause myself to have the most miserable day any sod has had on this earth. I'm going to cause myself so much frustration, disappointment, anger. I'm going to feel miserable and bitter and suicidal and confused and jealous and upset because that's, I cause it." What? What? And then when we have the self views itself as the cause, the outcome of that is to double the suffering. I caused it, I brought it on myself. It's all my fault. And then that heaps another load of darkness on top of that. And one is in hell. This is hell. Sometimes it's with regard to the other. And we say, "I really caused him or her a great deal of suffering." And sometimes, of course, we have to look and see what our responsibilities are. But how easy from the dark, not from wisdom and clear comprehension, but from the dark, that taking the view, "I caused the other suffering," or "They caused me," that the reactivity inhibits the opportunity to see in a completely fresh way. And when people say, "I am the cause," or "They are the cause," conflict, wars, friction, unhappiness must be the outcome. Can we just have enough mindfulness in the being just to be mindful of when the self is sliding and slipping into the notion of cause, making oneself or other the cause? Is it possible for us to have a slightly larger sense of what makes events happen? If I say, "My parents have caused me a lot of suffering," which could be true, so to speak. But then the parents could say, well, I'm like this, but I'm not the cause. My parents are the cause. And then the grandparents say, well, don't look at me. My great grandparents, they were the cause. That's what makes it. We go back to Adam and Eve. No, monkeys. Depends which side of the scientific religious divide. So every time there is the view that there's the cause, it can shift somewhere else. Our practice and our exploration with all of this is sense and knowing of the deep and the recognition in this case of the difficult deep and its influence upon perceptions, upon views there. And if we have any consistency of the same dark, narrow view, it's the duty of the human being to see what shows or bring out the experiential evidence to show something different. If I have a dark view of my past, then I need plenty of moments of remembrance of where the past had light in it, happiness in it, play in it, joy in it. So the Buddha's on this view says regularly, one is mindful of what is present, but one is also mindful of what is not present. And sometimes we're very mindful, in this case the past, of what was painful in the past. But we need to be mindful of what we have forgotten, what we have denied, what's distant from consciousness. And if we're calm and meditative, and we can look back, and every human being will look back in the past and see points of light in it. And they are important because they help to break up the idea of a heavy past. We need the points of light, the points of appreciation, the points of love, because those recognitions and appreciations are doorways of liberation from the dark. Meditations on the deep, key theme of the Buddha here. Sometimes with the deep, things move and touch perceptions. Calmness comes from the deep. Inner peace can come from the deep. Joy and happiness can come from the deep. And in Dharma language, no matter how deep we go, suffering, frankly, is not that deep. We like to use, I just used it for there. So a certain deep suffering, might call hell, it's not easy to work out and work through. But what's authentically deep and truly deep is much deeper than suffering. And the intimations for that depth, far beyond the suffering, the intimations for that do come to us, do touch our perceptions, and love, joy, happiness, peace, calmness, clear comprehension, gratitude, compassion, generosity, all this of the human being is there in the deep. All of those also express a liberation, an ability of the inner life of the heart to move freely through consciousness and thereby express something really beautiful. In the meditations, when there is the feeling of the deep, and we say, ah, this is the touch of heaven, and it is, and there is the touch of heaven, frankly, I would say, forget all the meditation methods and techniques, forget all the structures of the meditation forms and techniques, and just allow the whole being to experience the deep, manifesting or showing itself in consciousness as happiness and contentment and peace and love and compassion. To allow that to come through. The feeling element of these, of the heart is vitally important. And the danger of the meditations, that if we forget that, the feeling of the heart, if we forget the heart, as I mentioned the other day, the meditations have the danger of becoming dry. We need to listen deeply, and sometimes in the quiet listening deeply, we might ask ourselves, right now, in this sitting posture, what confirms love? In this sitting posture, what confirms it's a doorway for liberation? In this sitting posture, what confirms that life is immeasurable? In this sitting posture, what confirms that there are no boundaries? So though we may engage with our practices, our methods, and important and precious as they are, that the methodology is a little bit like scaffolding, understand the word? For the building. You know, you see in India they use bamboo poles to build the skyscrapers, and after a few mantras. And so methodologies and techniques are a temporary useful tool until the point that consciousness itself can be steady enough, not requiring so much in the way of the scaffolding, the methods and the techniques to hold the consciousness. So in the quiet stillness of the consciousness, there is a receptivity to the deep. That deep touches us. And as the Buddha spoke often enough, in such a way that it's a way of being in which the boundaries of life get softer and softer. And of course I know, as you will too, that a much beloved word in the culture, psychological culture here, is the word boundary. Dear beloved psychologists, love it. And so people will need to say, do say, it's all right if one's not interested in liberation. I must set my boundaries. Oh, careful, careful with this. Because the view then arises. And in the view that arises, I must set my boundaries. Easily begins to set walls, and you all know about walls in this country, begins to set a wall, a barrier, a boundary. And boundaries keep out and keep in. That's what a boundary does. But the boundary is dependent on the outer, the other side of the boundary. He, she, they, whatever, and the inside. And the agreement between the two holds the boundary. It holds the boundary. And one can keep resetting the boundary, provided the other agrees to it. It can be a constant struggle with boundary. I would tread carefully. This is an English understatement. I would tread carefully with the language of boundary. The boundary could end up as your own Guantanamo Bay. You understand Guantanamo Bay? Have you heard of that? It's a place where at currently 166 Arabs, Muslims are kept in a small, miserable jail under electric lights and torture by the US government because they are suspected that they may have been involved in terrorism. Guantanamo Bay. Got it? Yeah. When human beings get tighter and more controlled and set more and more boundaries, keeping out and very fixed, one is unconsciously building one's own Guantanamo Bay. One's locked in. And it's a tragic event. Dharma practice is not about the boundaries, but it is the mindful, clear comprehension in life of looking at situations and seeing, is there a doorway to liberation? What is the wisdom in this event? What is the wise way to respond to? And that movement comes best for a human being when we are able to, for the consciousness to be steady without lots of structure. To go from, as we touched before, form to formless. To be steady. To look quietly at a situation. Non-reactively. To communicate the voice. And in that communication to be clear what is yes and what is no. If I come in with my past ideas of boundary, it may be a disrespect to myself and a disrespect to the other. And in plenty of places in our life and in our political life, this issue needs some exploration for liberation. With the happiness, come back again, with the happiness that comes, this is the more good news at this time, with the happiness that comes, it's one of the sweetest feelings a human being can know. Happiness, human beings love to be happy. And the Dharma is a Dharma of the exploration of happiness. It explores it here as we do with some of the forms. And once again, the feelings of happiness have great depth and great subtlety to them. And I'm often notice, just in the one-to-ones or in the groups, that a person may feel really, really hellish, like I described, and in the very midst of the conversation, the person, happiness, in spite of their condition, keeps shining through. And I remembered the much-loved, and still loved, Leonard Cohen. And a friend, sadly, I was on retreat, you know, sometimes, and I'd rather have been at the Leonard Cohen concert, but however, some of us have to keep letting go. And so lots of my beloved friends went to see Leonard. And what's that lovely thing about the light coming in? What's that one-liner?
There's a crack in everything.
Ah! It's a profound truth. If you never hear another song in your whole life, you never pick up the Torah or some boring spiritual book, especially Buddhist, and you just remember one line. What's the line? There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. A well-spent life would be one which just contemplated this for the rest of life. Take it everywhere you go. It's a liberating statement. Say again. Because you might forget. Like me. Go on. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And Leonard, when he was at the O2 Concert Hall in London, lovely DVD. I'm promoting it. I'm not getting any backsheesh for it. said, I loved it. Leonard, no, he's a good meditator, he's a good yogi. You know, he'd be at home on the cushion here. He listed the whole list of antidepressants. He told this audience of 2,000 people, this whole list of antidepressants that he was taking. And he said, but still, happiness kept coming through. I thought, is that right? Yeah. I thought, right, absolutely. The happiness, despite everything, still kept coming through. And I notice it again and again and again. People come, they look absolutely heavy, they're depressed. They're on a retreat, they're looking for a rope, etc. They have a meeting with one of us, and right in the middle of this, some smile comes out. In the darkness, there's a crack in everything, and that's where the light comes through. And we need to catch that light. Even in the dark, there's a doorway of liberation. And something just person can't stop themselves from smiling in the midst of something. And those moments that, of course, we prefer it to be the other way around, which would be, there is light, but sometimes there's a little crack in it, and the dark comes through. This is better. This would be my choice, anyway, if I had one, you know. If there was such a thing as choice. So perhaps we ask Leonard to write a song that, you know, there's light, but sometimes there's a little crack in it and the dark comes through. So the happiness and the joy that moves through our being, it's a receptivity and a full acknowledgement to it. Not to make ourselves busy, not to control our meditations, not to try and get on with our life, but to allow that to move through into the field of consciousness, into the field of perception, and let go in those times of everything else. Feel it. It's the best feeling. Happiness, love, compassion, joy, gratitude, appreciation. It's the best of human feelings. And we're paying a terrible price for making our life busy, preoccupied, and when it comes, we haven't got time to taste it and enjoy it because we've got something else to do. Oh, the riches of life we throw away for some petty little things out there. Tragic. Tragic for human beings. But when we let the happiness come through, the light come through, it's healing. It brings health to the body. It brings a sense of well-being. And then the Buddha says with this, this is so beautiful, these experiences of appreciative joy and love and friendship. He makes he says it in a very poetic way. He'll say, oh, spread the love everywhere, in all the directions, to all people, to all things. Spread it everywhere. So it's another way of saying very directly, let love have what? No boundaries. Apologies to the psychologists. Let love have no boundaries. Let's learn to live without boundaries, and let's trust we have the quiet authority to say yes and to say no. To be for and to be against. To be with and not to be with. And we'll take it on the situation there. So the appreciative joys of life, we have to and we need to sometimes actively, we can use the language of choice here, actively remember the beauties of life, the wonders of life, what there is to appreciate and feel grateful for. And if we don't do that, we'll miss so much, because our petty little mind is occupied with petty little events. And therefore, the word sati carries with it both, of course, and recognition of being in the present moment, yes, but it also, like with the Sanskrit smriti, it carries with it the flavor of memory, of recollection. And so gratitude and appreciation comes sometimes through the intentional choice, if you wish to acknowledge and recognize and touch upon the gratitude and the appreciation to bring something beautiful out. And sometimes, I notice with elderly people, actually I'm in that category. anyway, getting older. Or sometimes with people who have sickness, I mean severe sickness, are actually on the edge of death, are knowing in days or hours or weeks or whatever it might be. And sometimes when the human being is on the edge of, or we clearly know we are getting closer to, it would appear that there was a kind of possible, I don't know what is after. I don't know, kind of Buddhist sense, I don't know, do I have this one life? I don't know if I will be back again. I just don't know. But what I do know, aging and life-threatening illness, what I do know that I'm here. And sometimes human beings, and sometimes it's a privilege to meet these human beings who are living on the edge of death, and it's not in despair, they're not in the dark, the expression of it is gratitude for every moment of life. Really deep appreciation. And I think sometimes when we meet these people, I go, whoa, bless you. There's such an inspiration for us that people can live not knowing the hour or the day, only knowing it's extremely close. And there's a brightness in the face. Person may hardly be able to move. And yet the language is a language of gratitude, of appreciation, of still the capacity to be touched with life. There's some extraordinary human beings on this earth. And that recognition, that divine capacity of the human being to be in that way, that gratitude then is, as the Buddha said, a doorway for liberation. It's a liberation from terror, from fear, from death, from anxiety. And gratitude can really bring that out of us. But, I mean, are we going to have to wait till we're nearly dead before we have some wealth of gratitude? And certainly, if I may say, finally, in my own years of privilege, And like some of you who move in different circles, have perhaps a wide good networks of friends and sanghas and contact. Every year, I would say most months, somebody sends me a message. Say, did you know so-and-so died? Did you know so-and-so has a cancer? Do you know so-and-so has? And as the years go by, we hear more and more names of people we've known, we've sat with, we've been on retreats with, we've had coffee with, we've laughed and joked and cried and communicated with, no longer walking on this earth. And we need to sometimes remember the loved ones, the past ones. Need to remember the wonders and joys of life, of the appreciation of the power of love and gratitude. Need to remember, let's work with the dark. Let's see where the light is in the dark. And that extraordinary commitment to all that is genuinely a liberating and awakened way of being in this world. And there is no substitute for it. Nothing can replace love. Nothing can replace liberation. Thank you.